This is an ABC podcast.
Good morning. Welcome to AM. I'm Sabra Lane, coming to you from Nipaluna, Hobart. The federal government's fine-tuned the wording around the question Australians will be asked to vote on in a referendum later this year about a constitutional change that would allow the setting up of an Indigenous voice to Parliament. The voice, as it's been called, would be a permanent body representing First Nations people. It would advise government on policies and laws which affect their lives, but it wouldn't be able to deliver programs and it would have no veto power over Parliament. But is it enough to win bipartisan support for the referendum? The Federal Liberal Party is still undecided. The Federal Attorney General, Mark Dreyfus, joined me a short time ago. Mark Dreyfus, the Prime Minister says the referendum will be an inspiring and unifying moment. But what if it's a no result? What kind of moment will that be for the country?
We're focused on success, Sabra. And I think it's important to not let moments like yesterday pass. We too often quickly move on in this Parliament House. And yesterday was a really momentous day. It was a day when we've announced the final wording of the amendment to the Constitution that we're going to bring to the Parliament next week in a Constitution alteration bill. First time that's happened set for 23 years. And it's a tremendous opportunity for our country.
Does it weigh on
you? That's the way we need to look at it. It very much weighs on me. My very first job out of university was working with the Northern Land Council, a land rights organisation in the Northern Territory. And I've been working with Aboriginal organisations, not continuously, but on and off for about 40 years. And this is a really important moment for our country. It will improve the country, as the Prime Minister said yesterday, and it will improve our standing in the rest of the world. The world is looking at what we are doing, and I'm hoping that every Australian can bring themselves to vote yes when we hold the referendum later this year.
You need a majority of voters across the country, a majority of states backing the change, and usually you need bipartisan support in getting referenda up. Bipartisanship now looks impossible. The government did provide more details yesterday on how the representatives would be chosen for the voice, their terms, the composition, and the phrasing around the legislative power of Parliament was added. But this all seems to apparently have just hardened the Liberals' opposition to this. Are you prepared to lay out more detail ahead of the referendum if that's what it takes to get the Liberals on board?
We are still hoping that the opposition will get on board. I urge Mr. Dutton and his colleagues to support this referendum. It's a really important step for our country. And of course, we're going to keep talking to the opposition, just as we have been listening to the community, listening to First Nations leaders since the election and getting this right. We are going to keep listening to what the opposition has to say and do everything that we can to get them on board.
Liberal leader Peter Dutton says the wording still may not be enough to satisfy some of his colleagues within the party. As you say, the bill will be introduced next week with an immediate inquiry and a vote in June. Is that leaving this all too late?
I think that we need to also remember the path that we've travelled to get to this point. We've been talking about recognition of our Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander peoples for decades. The process that led to the Uluru Statement from the Heart in 2017 started in 2010. There have been parliamentary inquiries, there have been conventions, there have been dialogues. And after the Uluru Statement from the Heart, that generous offer to the whole of our country, after that we had in the last two parliaments, further parliamentary inquiries. The time's here. The time is now to get on with this. And I don't think we've left it too late. I think we are at the end of a process. We're now going to introduce the bill in Parliament next week, and it will go, as you've just said, to a joint select committee to examine, have another public inquiry, and that'll be another opportunity for people to put forward views. And then the bill will be debated in the House of Representatives and in the Senate, and by the end of June, we'll be headed to the referendum.
I know that you're focused on getting a yes, but don't we need to examine the consequences of if that does not happen? Don't people need to understand that? What do you think the consequences will be?
I think it would be a very long time before we returned to any question of recognition. I think it would be a tremendous setback for relations with our First Peoples. And I'm focused on success because the consequences of failure would be dire.
You say that you're still talking with the opposition. Is there a chance that you will provide more details, or do you see this through the prism that former High Court Judge Kenneth Hain does? He says asking for more details is just a distraction.
In many ways, the requests for details or the asking of questions were asking questions that Mr. Dutton already knew the answers to. So you do have to think, well, why are all these questions still being asked? I'd invite Mr. Dutton to have a long, hard think and a long, hard look at the simple words that we've unveiled yesterday and the simple question that'll be put to the Australian people on referendum day, and look into his heart and think about the tremendous improvement that this will be for our country if we have recognition of our First Peoples in the Constitution and a voice to make representations to the Parliament and the Executive on matters that concern Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people. That will be a tremendous step forward. Putting this in the Constitution is a tremendous step forward, and I hope he can bring himself and his party to support this.
You've sought urgent advice from the Australian Federal Police Commissioner about what happened yesterday at a protest outside Parliament House where Independent Senator Lydia Thorpe was knocked to the ground while she was trying to make an appearance there. Have you got that advice back?
Not yet. And obviously the footage was concerning. The AFP has announced that it has referred that incident to the AFP's Professional Standards Command for investigation.
Before you go, do you regret your attack on Mr. Dutton earlier this week, accusing him of silence regarding the protests in Victoria where Nazis were present?
No, I don't. There's no place in Australian society for public displays of Nazi symbols or the Nazi salute. And Mr. Dutton has still not uttered a word of condemnation of a Victorian Liberal Member of Parliament, Moira Deeming, for her attendance at that disgraceful rally in Melbourne. The leader of the opposition, the Liberal leader of the opposition in Victoria, Mr. Pesciuto, moved immediately to expel Moira Deeming from the Liberal Party. Mr. Dutton can't even bring himself to mention her name. And in the meantime,
he sought to bring forward a private member's bill in Parliament this week banning Nazi symbols.
That was not the point that I made in the Parliament. I called on Mr. Dutton to join the Leader of the Opposition in Victoria in condemning the actions of a Liberal Member of Parliament in Victoria, and he still hasn't done this. And meanwhile, senior members of his front bench, and I'm talking Senator Henderson, Senator Antic, and Senator Canavan, are endorsing Ms. Deeming and apparently working to undermine the Liberal Leader of the Opposition in Victoria for daring to stand up to the right-wing extremists in the Liberal Party. So no, I don't regret what I said about Mr. Dutton at all, and I'm still calling on him to condemn the actions of the Liberal in Victoria. He is the senior Liberal in Australia, and it's up to him to stand up to this kind of behaviour.
Attorney General Mark Dreyfus, thanks for joining AM.
Thank you very much.
The Federal Attorney General Mark Dreyfus. New South Wales voters will cast their ballots tomorrow in a fiercely contested state election, but the voter demographic has undergone a significant shift since the Coalition won office 12 years ago. This time, the parties are having to convince an increasing number of younger voters. Those citizens are emerging as an influential bloc, especially in key seats in Western Sydney. A reporter, Matt Bamford, has been seeking them out.
It's lunchtime at Parramatta Square in the heart of Western Sydney, and local musician Brett performs for a crowd of office workers and students. It's a pleasing sight for the singer, who still remembers how his industry was decimated during the pandemic.
It wasn't great. In and out, very thankful for the help we did get from the government, obviously. I know a lot of musicians who kind of went, that's it, I'm done, and gone for more stable work through that. I actually thought they did a pretty good job, given no one had a clue what was going on.
But as he considers who to vote for in tomorrow's state election, there are other issues on his mind.
For me personally, I tend to think about the climate policy, being a musician, whatever the arts policies as well, what they're funding into that.
The seat of Parramatta is held by the Liberals on a 6% margin, but long-time member Jeff Lee is retiring and the area is undergoing a demographic shift. Half of enrolled voters here are under 45, lower than the state average, and the number of younger voters is growing. 24-year-old bank worker Dean is concerned about housing affordability.
Cost of living is very tough, especially just starting work, trying to buy property and all that. Getting into the market is a tough thing to do. Prices aren't coming down and it's not cancelling each other out at this stage.
Normally a Liberal voter, this time he's thinking of switching parties.
I'm going to vote Labor probably for the first time in my life. They've done a lot of funding to schools and the hospital stuff. They've said they're going to fund that. And I think it is time for more funding to go there, especially with all the strikes, the nurses, teachers. I think, it's about time.
Issues like cost of living and housing affordability generally impact young voters more. Demographer Dr. Liz Allen says as this cohort increases in size, it sets up a generational divide.
We've seen the decline in home ownership to the point now that in Australia, if you're 45 years and under, you are less likely to own your home or have the prospects of owning your home. So the needs of the younger population and the pressures for younger people are in stark competition to those that have experienced very different rates of home ownership, of costs of living, and so on.
The major parties have made some efforts to ease the pressure of concerns like housing affordability, but Dr. Allen says it's been fairly limited.
We've not really seen any earnest attempt by either of the major political parties in New South Wales to appeal to the needs and the wants of young people and people with families in New South Wales, particularly when we consider how young people and people with children really fear for the future.
As baby boomer numbers decline, Dr. Allen says parties must shift their focus to younger voters or risk a backlash at the ballot box.
This election and elections to come will really need to invest in earnest concerns that are held by young people. Otherwise, their success will be short-lived.
Dr. Liz Allen from the Australian National University, Matt Bamford reporting there. Regardless of who wins tomorrow's poll, palliative care specialists will be watching closely. They're hoping the next government will act in the face of growing skill shortages and poor access to services in some areas. Catherine Gregory takes a look.
It was some of her darkest days, but Marilyn McCann is still thankful for the support she received from staff at a Western Sydney hospital when her husband was dying.
Even down to the people that gave you a cup of tea in the morning.
Marilyn's husband died from metastasised prostate cancer 2 years ago. Living in Western Sydney, she's aware of how lucky she was to get one of the last beds available on the ward.
The girl who was in charge said to me, you want this bed, you have to say yes today. And I said, don't make me say yes today. And she said, I won't have the bed tomorrow. And so we said yes.
She had to travel far each day to see her husband.
It was horrendous. I don't understand why there wasn't one close to where we lived.
Dr. Philip Lee is an advocate and former director of palliative care for Western Sydney, home to a huge population of Sydneysiders.
In the western suburbs of Sydney have been the area that have been struggling for quite a long time and still are relatively under resourced compared to the rest of metropolitan Sydney. Funding has certainly been the issue for a lot of services.
Last year, the New South Wales Perrottet government announced an additional $743 million funding boost over a five-year period for palliative care hospital and community services in the state. While Dr. Lee welcomes the funding, he says it will take a while to see the benefits in the Western Sydney LHD.
So it's going to take a long time before Western Sydney catches up with the other metropolitan areas.
For example, he says until recently, the LHD only had 16 palliative care beds, with another 10 added just this month. Comparatively, he says in northern Sydney, which has a smaller population, there are 51 beds for adults and 8 beds for young people. But Dr. Lee is very pleased. A specialist palliative care ward will be re-established at Westmead Hospital in Western Sydney after it was closed down more than a decade ago.
When the ward is being planned and to be re-established, it's crucial that very early, before the ward opens, that they look at how they're going to staff that palliative care unit.
But as the New South Wales government says, palliative care is not just about bed numbers, as many people choose to have in-home care services as well. A former palliative care community nurse in Western Sydney, who we'll call Rachel, hopes improving those in-home services will also be a priority with whichever party wins the state election.
When I originally started working in the community, community palliative care service was excellent. And over the time, it just got eroded by budget cuts.
Palliative care advocates hope both sides of politics will match and enhance existing funding commitments. Labor says it will continue to do that and work on safe staffing levels.
Catherine Gregory reporting. American concerns about the social media app TikTok have taken center stage in Washington today as the company's chief executive fronted a congressional committee. During 4.5 hours, skeptical lawmakers hammered Shou Chu with questions about Chinese government control of TikTok and harmful content posted on it. North America correspondent Barbara Miller was there.
The committee will come to order.
The gavel fell on what was to be a feisty hearing as TikTok CEO made his first appearance before Congress.
Thank you for your time. I am Shou Chu, and I'm from Singapore.
Shou Chu came here knowing he had a steep hill to climb. The Biden administration is considering banning TikTok because of national security concerns if its Chinese parent company doesn't sell its stake.
Let me start by addressing a few misconceptions about ByteDance, of which we are a subsidiary. ByteDance is not owned or controlled by the Chinese government. It's a private company.
And he talked about an initiative TikTok hopes will convince lawmakers the data of its 150 million US users can't be accessed by foreign governments.
We call this initiative Project Texas. Today, US TikTok data is stored by default in Oracle servers. Only vetted personnel operating in a new company called TikTok US Data Security can control access to this data.
But it was a tough audience. The frosty tone set by Energy and Commerce Committee Chair Kathy Rogers.
Chinese Communist Party is able to use this as a tool to manipulate America as a whole. Your platform should be banned.
Over several hours, committee member after committee member used their allotted time to express skepticism about Mr. Chu's claims and quiz him about why harmful content was often not removed from the app. There was drama when Congresswoman Kat Kamak played a TikTok video to the hearing, which appeared to depict a threat to committee members.
You couldn't take action after 41 days when a clear threat, a very violent threat to the chairwoman of this committee and the members of this committee was posted on your platform. You damn well know that you cannot protect the data and security of this committee or the 150 million users of your app, because it is an extension of the CCP.
Shou Chu was not given the chance to respond, but after the break, he said he'd been briefed that the video had now been removed. It was all a far cry from his upbeat TikTok video ahead of the appearance.
Let me know in the comments what you want your elected representatives to know about what you love about TikTok.
A number of lawmakers asked him to come back to them with detailed answers to their questions. TikTok and its CEO have much work to do. This is Barbara Miller in Washington reporting for AM.
That's AM for today. Thanks for your company. I'm Sabra Lane.
Hi, I'm Sam Hawley, host of the ABC News Daily podcast. You may have seen the clip by now of the Senator Lydia Thorpe being thrown to the ground by police outside Parliament House in Canberra. She was trying to confront a British anti-transgender campaigner whose tour of Australia has attracted support from neo-Nazis, including at a rally in Melbourne. Today, an expert on the far right, on what's fueling a rise in extremism. Look for the ABC News Daily podcast on the ABC Listen app.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.